It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, we'll talk to a bioethics expert about the death of Brittany Maynard, a young woman suffering from terminal brain cancer.
First, it's Election Day in Wisconsin and around the country. Wisconsinites are headed to the polls to vote for the next governor, for members of Congress, and a lot of other really important issues.
We're checking in with city and county clerks from around the state to see how things are going at the polls so far today. First up, we have Jamie Firehelm. She's Pierce County Clerk. Jamie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, good afternoon. That would be a he, not a she.
I'm sorry.
I don't alarm anybody.
I was skipping ahead to my next guest already. Sorry about that, Jamie. Thank you for joining us. So far, how are things going there in Pierce County?
Very smoothly. Very smoothly. Not many questions, you know, a few questions, but nothing real critical. Things going quite smoothly, quite quietly. From what I can tell, a good turnout.
And are you getting questions from the local election workers at polling stations?
Yes, I've gotten a few questions. I had to think about that a minute.
Sure.
I've gotten questions about some of the clerks being concerned about running short of ballots, and then I probably received one or two other questions about how to deal with absentee ballots, but...
Has the back and forth about voter ID created confusion for anybody, or does that seem to be the non-voter ID election seem to be working okay?
Not today. Not today, as much as I thought that it might. I had gotten several questions prior to today about whether voter ID was, as they put it, on or off. But today, I don't believe I've gotten even one question about that today.
And apart from some stations running short on ballots, any other problems at the polls today in your area?
Nope, not that I've heard. And that's, even the running low on ballots is something that they can remedy long before the polls close. So it's not a concern, but they were just looking for some help there, and we backed them up on that account.
And I always wonder, Jamie, how late at night do you usually work on a big election like this?
We'll be here, in my estimate anyway, at least till midnight.
All right. Well, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, no problem.
Now we go to Lisa Quinn. She's the clerk and treasurer for the city of Schofield. Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So how are things going there in Schofield so far on what I imagine is a busy election day?
Yes, it is actually a busy election day. We're already at 44% of our registered voters.
So that's a pretty 44%. Solid turnout with I imagine you get an after-work rush, too?
Yes, actually, right around between 5 and 6:30, that's probably the busiest part of the day for us.
And now, have you heard from local election workers any questions about how things are going today?
I check in on them periodically because we're actually the clerk's office and the voting station is in the same building. So I check in with them about every hour, and so far everything's been going smoothly.
Okay. How late do you end up working on an election night like this there in Schofield?
In Schofield, actually, we're here until about maybe 10 o'clock. Our election ladies have been doing this for years, and they're so in tune with how to get everything done at the end of the evening. They're pretty efficient about it.
Now, on a procedural level, are you there counting votes by hand or watching the results come in for machines? How does that work?
Yes. For the city of Schofield, we actually have a machine that tallies all the votes for us. And then at the end of the evening, the election workers... they actually pull out all of the ballots and separate them up for write-in information that will go to the county clerk.
What is turnout usually like at your stations?
This is pretty high. We do real well between the general elections for federal and then those for state are usually pretty high turnout for the city of Schofield.
And as I asked Jamie Firehelm, has there been confusion or questions about the non-voter ID nature of this election?
No, we haven't. With this morning before the election polls opened, we made sure that we talked with all of the election workers so that they understood that they will not have to accept ID, and anyone that may ask, that they can just tell them that we don't need that in order for them to receive a ballot if they're registered.
And we've heard around the state a lot of early voting, either absentee or in-person absentee, I think it's called. Did you have a lot of that there?
We had about 9% of our registered voters that did that absentee.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Lisa, for joining us and bringing us up to date there.
You're welcome. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Well, we continue our little survey of clerks around the state on Election Day, checking in on just what's going on with our voting today. We go now to Joseph Zarneski. He's the Milwaukee County Clerk. Joe, thanks for joining us on a busy day.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure.
Well, how are things going in Milwaukee County today in the election?
Things are going very smoothly. We have had no major problems at any of our polling locations so far today.
Now, how does it work in Milwaukee County? Does the city have its own deal and then the rest of the county have a separate vote tallying procedure?
Each one of our 19 municipalities, cities, and villages tallies their own votes, and then tonight they will report them into us here at the county, and we will enter those votes into the GAB SVRS system to complete the unofficial tally.
And now I know sometimes there are lines, especially in the city of Milwaukee itself. Are you hearing anything about waits to vote, maybe rush hour this morning?
Early this morning, there were lines at a number of polling locations. They weren't as long of lines as you would see in a presidential election, but people are saying they were certainly longer than a typical gubernatorial election and comparable to what we saw in the 2012 recall election.
And what kind of questions are you getting from local election workers, if any?
We're not getting a lot of questions about that. People were very well trained. All of our municipal clerks did an outstanding job of training their poll workers for today. We haven't had a lot of confusion about voter ID, so we think the word got out pretty well that photo ID is not required to vote in today's election. About the only question we had were people registering at the polls. Questions about what constitutes proof of residency in order to register at the polls on Election Day. Other than that, things have been going very, very smoothly.
I imagine those are questions you get pretty much every election season.
That is true. People want to know how to register to vote at the polls on Election Day and what documentation they need. And again, all of our poll workers in all of our municipalities are very well trained, and they're able to handle that. But sometimes the lines do get a little long because it takes a little bit of time for people to register at the polls.
And Joe, you've got a goodly number of people there in Milwaukee County. Does that mean you get results fairly late at night?
Yeah, we're probably going to have a late night, early morning tonight before we get all the results. Voter turnout is high. Certainly higher than in a typical gubernatorial election, and approaching, if not exceeding, the turnout level we saw in the 2012 recall. Some areas are reporting turnouts that could approach turnout levels in a presidential election. Other areas are saying it's more typical of a gubernatorial election. But the turnout is definitely high, which means we'll probably be in for a late night.
All right, Joe, hit that caffeine now, and thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Joseph Zarneski. He's Milwaukee County Clerk. Thanks also to Jamie Firehelm, Pierce County Clerk, and Lisa Quinn, Clerk and Treasurer for the City of Schofield. We're digging into an issue that's made a lot of headlines lately. This spring, 29-year-old Brittany Maynard was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. Doctors gave her 6 months to live.
After researching treatment options and a prognosis, Maynard decided she would pursue death with dignity. It's an option available for terminally ill patients that meets some requirements in 5 states.
Here's a clip of Maynard talking about how she felt once she filled her prescription for end-of-life drugs.
I can't even tell you the amount of relief that it provides me to know that I don't have to die the way that it's been described to me that my brain tumor would take me on its own.
Brittany Maynard's reopening the conversation right now about the Right to Die movement in the United States. Dr. Baron Lerner is here with us to talk about that debate now. He's a professor of medicine and population health in the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University Langone Medical Center. He's also the author of The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi, glad to be here.
Well, on Saturday, Brittany Maynard took her own life with legally prescribed drugs from her doctor. What was her death like?
It was a death in this manner is generally gradual and peaceful. I mean, we don't know all the details, obviously, but the whole point of the aid in dying movement is to have a death that is as calm and controlled as possible. And the overdose of pills that people take generally make them gradually get more and more tired, sort of fall asleep, and then eventually pass away.
Now, she was prescribed the medication to have that death under the Oregon Death with Dignity Act. Can you tell us a little bit about that law and how it works?
That law was passed in 1997. It was the first one in the United States, and it's known as the Death with Dignity Act. And it basically allows patients who are terminally ill under very controlled circumstances to request a prescription from their doctor that they can then choose to use to end their life. And again, this is done, there's a bunch of hoops that people need to jump through, including asking themselves the first time, writing down a request, getting a second doctor's approval, that sort of thing. But if all of the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, a patient who is terminally ill has that option in Oregon and a few other states.
Do you have any idea how many people have used that option in Oregon?
Yeah, there's data. I don't have the exact numbers. It's roughly, I think, since 1997, more than 1,000 people have requested the medications, and about 750 or so have actually used them. So one interesting thing that we found is that not everybody uses them. That was sort of surprising, I think, at the start. But about 60%, I think, will go on and actually use the medication.
But there were hundreds that have used them over the years. But Brittany Maynard's death and her life before that, her openness about her choices and what she was considering, they sparked a new conversation. What was different about her in the way that she approached this?
Well, several things. One is she was willing and interested in going public with her story, which I think has been very, very useful in getting the discussion going. There was a lot of talk about physician aid in dying many years ago, but these topics always sort of come and go in interest, and it hadn't really been on the front pages for a while. So she was an eager participant in talking about what she was doing. And secondly, I think it's hard not to be compelled by a story of a 29-year-old woman just at the beginning of her life, married, and getting such a terrible tumor that was clearly going to kill her in such a rapid amount of time. So I think the combination of her openness and the dramatic nature of this terrible brain tumor in such a young person explains why we're so fascinated by what happened.
As we look at the choice that she made, what were her options aside from the one that she took?
I think that the other options, and it's very important to point these out because this is absolutely not for everybody, the other options were to get the treatment that she did, and then at some point in conjunction with her doctors, if they were going to stop aggressive treatments, there are lots of medications and other strategies that we would lump under the term of palliative care. So we're not going for a cure anymore, but we're making sure the person's comfortable, they have a good quality of life. Another option at the very end also might have been hospice, which is sort of a more formal program of palliative care where all of the treatment is devoted particularly to making the person comfortable and happy as possible at the end of their lives, relieving their symptoms and making sure that they get to visit with the people that they want to.
Now, we heard in that audio clip from one of her videos that she was horrified at the kind of death that the doctors told her she would have if she let the disease take its course with the various treatment options, and it would eventually end her life at the end of that, you know, 6 months or whatever it was. Is that, do you think, a reason that a lot of people consider is the kind of death that they have now and not just the length of the life?
Absolutely. She had, from what I've read, she had already experienced a lot of complications from the tumor, such as seizures. I think, I don't know if she actually had a stroke, but her brain was acting as if she did. So she was already getting very debilitated. It would only get worse. As the tumor gets larger and larger and you lose more and more brain function, she would have been increasingly immobile, helpless, dependent on others, possibly in more pain, more nausea. You never know. Every case is different. But these were reasonable things to expect as she got worse and worse. And another important point in her case, she was 29 years old and probably had as healthy a heart and kidneys as you can imagine. So she potentially could have lived an incredibly long time in a very, very debilitated state had she not chosen to do this.
Now, it's worth pointing out that the route she chose, it was not doctor-assisted suicide. It was death with dignity. Can you talk a little bit about the differences?
Yeah, the whole point of the Death with Dignity Act is that the doctor, and one of the interesting things is looking at how the language has changed, and sometimes the devil's in the details. So initially, people were using terms like doctor-assisted suicide, which somehow implied that doctors were there at the time and actually administering things. And people realize that's absolutely not what's going on. That's not a good term. So we also talk about things like aid in dying. That's another term that's been used. And death with dignity is what Oregon has chosen. And again, the point to emphasize is that the interaction with patient and doctor occurs in the doctor's office as part of the care of the patient. Lots of discussion goes into this. But when and if the patient decides to use the medications, the doctor is not present. Who will be present is usually the close family and whoever the patient decided to invite at that time. So the role of the doctor is a finite one. It's helpful, but they're not actively involved.
And this is available in 5 states, right?
Yeah, I think it's 5 now. Oregon, Washington, Montana, Vermont. I mean, it's either, there may be one more. It's on a bunch of ballots coming up, but several other states are also attempting to put laws in as well. I think it's 4 or 5 now.
And Brittany Mader wanted to influence the public debate by going so public with what she was going through. Has she succeeded?
Oh, you bet. I mean, that's why we're here today. Yeah, I think, again, you know, and a point I'd like to reiterate is a minority. It's interesting. When the Oregon law was first passed, a lot of ethicists and other folks were sort of pulling their hair out and saying, oh, my God, this means people are all going to, everyone with a terminal illness is going to rush to Oregon and do this. And we found exactly the opposite. So there's really a select group of people who, for on a combination of their illness and their personality and their families, feel that this is an option that they want to explore. A lot of people talk about control. A lot of people are concerned about unremitting pain or nausea that might not be treatable by medication. So you're talking about a small percent of people. Most people, a vast, vast majority of people will die not through this means and using things like palliative care and hospice that in many cases actually can control symptoms extremely well, even at the end of life.
Now, there have been critics about what Brittany Mader did, and one of the criticisms is that should the United States move in this direction, we face, you know, the slippery slope argument, that there might be a case like this, a young person who has a terminal illness, 6 months to live, and maybe horrible pain and debilitation at the end, but there might be someone else who maybe is depressed. There was a woman in Holland who had tinnitus, ringing ears, and wanted to end her life. And exactly where you draw that line?
Well, this is why there's safeguards in place. Doctors, for example, would not classify a depressed person with tinnitus as terminally ill, one hopes. So the underlying question to start is what is the illness, and is it truly indeed a terminal illness? Now, I will say that you mentioned Holland, and certainly we had experience in this country many years ago with Jack Kevorkian, who was more actively assisting patients with suicide, and many of the people that he assisted in retrospect were not terminal. So there's always the danger of misuse of this type of a technology, this type of a procedure, but I don't think that's a reason not to offer it. It's a reason to tighten up the structures that doctors follow for this and patients follow, and to, quite frankly, study it and make sure that these things aren't happening.
We're talking right now with bioethicist Dr. Baron Lerner of the NYU Langone Medical Center about the Right to Die movement. This weekend, terminal cancer patient Brittany Maynard decided to end her life on her own terms with a prescription she got from a doctor under Oregon's Death with Dignity Law.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up on our discussion with bioethicist Baron Lerner about the Right to Die movement in the United States. It's been sparked by the death of Brittany Maynard.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. If you were diagnosed with a terminal illness, would you want this option of what Oregon is calling death with dignity? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our first caller now. David is joining us in Spring Green. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you? Well, I'm very much in favor of death with dignity, and I would like to have that option myself. I have an incident in my own family. My mother's younger sister was diagnosed with spinal cord cancer. They lived in Los Angeles. And this was in the 1950s, and it progressed. And by the time she was in her early 30s, she was terminally ill, a paraplegic, and, they fortunately had a good enough relationship with, their doctor. She wanted to, die. And, even though I don't think it was any part of a legal apparatus at the time, the doctor did authorize a lethal dose of morphine, and she was able to pass on her own terms. And I think it was something that my grandmother and her whole family, I wasn't born at the time, but felt that it was the right thing to do, and they were grateful that they were able to do it for her. I would say, though, that as a footnote, my grandmother then became very active in what used to be called the Hemlock Society. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to have control over her own death and you know, choose when that was going to be. She did end up stockpiling some sleeping medication that she had gone down to Mexico to get. And when she was 87, about a year after her husband of 62 years passed away, she decided to go ahead and take her own life, even though she was not terminally ill. And, you know, that's sort of a different situation. That's more, you know, obviously a suicide. But she felt philosophically that she had a right to do it, and I guess I have a hard time disagreeing with her.
Okay, thank you, David. Thank you for sharing those stories. It's interesting how it went through the two members of your family, and obviously your grandmother believed in what she had done. And it's also interesting, Dr. Lerner, that the morphine was something that happened there via the doctor. Is this something that perhaps happens more often than we think, just not framed as doctor-assisted suicide?
These days, that's pretty hard to do. I think this reflects a more sophisticated approach to end-of-life issues. So that is not an uncommon story from that era. Controlled substances were much less highly regulated, et cetera. Now, we give a lot of morphine to terminally ill patients and other medications, but we give it not to end their lives, but to treat their discomfort, whether it's shortness of breath or pain. If the person happens to stop breathing during that treatment and die, that is an expected possible outcome. But we would not call that euthanasia at all, whereas the first story that the caller made sounds like euthanasia, which is really something that should really be rare in this country or really anywhere, I think. Certainly a doctor playing that role.
Well, thank you for that call, David. And we're going to go next to Jean joining us in Ashland. Hi, Jean.
Hi. The doctor and the patient show tremendous ignorance. Suicide is murder of the self, and murder has consequences no matter who it's done to. And there's not enough thinking or education. They simply want to escape their temporary. Don't worry, we all die. They're just their temporary situation, and
so Jean,
there's much to know.
Jean, are you objecting on religious grounds?
Religious grounds. You don't. It all depends on whether you believe in afterlife or not. If you think this is just what this is all we have, and so let's get on with it and be dead. That's the wrong thinking.
Okay, thank you so much, Jean, for calling and sharing your thoughts. And Jean's saying it's murder of the self, and it's wrong.
This is a big push button issue, and there have always been very strong arguments against suicide. Both from a religious and a moral perspective, and those are going to persist. And people are definitely entitled to that argument. I think to underscore in this particular case is that this is a voluntary thing. No one is mandating this. We don't even want to be using the word suicide because of those connotations, I think. There's a difference of opinion. So while some people really feel that any type of premature ending of life is murder or wrong, there are many others who make a cogent argument that in particular circumstances, being more aggressive than merely waiting for your body to stop working is appropriate.
Well, thank you, Gene, for the call. And we're going to go next to John in Dickeyville. Hi, John.
Yes. Am I on?
Uh-huh. You're on the air.
Okay. In May of last year, I had the unfortunate task of finding my brother, who was an MS survivor, or MS sufferer. He had taken his life in his basement by using a gun. Had he been able to use the option of assisted suicide, he could have done it with more dignity, and I wouldn't have had to, you know, find him there with a gun to his head in the basement of his house.
I'm sorry you went through that, and sorry for your brother as well, and thank you for sharing your thoughts on this. Dr. Lerner, is this an option that you think would prevent people from doing more drastic things, having more control?
Yeah, I think it is a good option in that sense. There are always people who, at the end of an illness, a terminal illness, have been feeling that they need to end their lives. Obviously, we don't know all the details in this particular case. One hopes it was not something like depression. And, you know, one of the other advantages of the death with dignity type deaths is that there's a doctor involved. So the pills, again, would not be given unless they've made sure the patient isn't depressed, that there aren't other possible things to happen. This poor man, without that option, decided to take matters into his own hands, literally. It's obviously a very, very sad story, and one does hope that, again, for that segment of patients interested in this type of option, I do think getting pills from your doctor and going through the whole process is the most humane and logical way to try.
And we leave it there. Dr. Lerner, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Baron Lerner, Professor of Medicine and Population Health in the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University Langone Medical Center. Herbie Hancock is a living legend today. The pianist, keyboardist, composer, and bandleader has a career that spans 5 decades and has earned him 14 Grammy Awards.
Hancock is known for pushing the boundaries of jazz, and his work influences R&B, acoustic, and electronic jazz.
He has a new memoir out detailing his musical life, his struggle with drug addiction, and his turn toward Buddhism. It's called Herbie Hancock, Possibilities.
Herbie Hancock joins us now. Herbie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, one theme I keep seeing in your book is that you, in music, embrace change and love to push boundaries. Where does that come from?
I think it's in my DNA. It comes from my interest in science. I've always been kind of analytical and curious about things. I like to know how things work and what would happen if you put this with that. So that innate curiosity has helped me along the way. It also came into question when that curiosity, you know, sometimes curiosity kills the cat. And I talk in my book about a substance abuse problem that I had with crack cocaine. So that's going to shock a lot of people. But it's a reality that happened in my life, and I was able to overcome it. You know, and which I'm very proud of and very happy about. And the reason I'm writing about it in this book is because perhaps I can help someone else who is suffering with some kind of addiction, that you can do this. You can win over that dark side and never give up.
What got you through that dark side? What got you through addiction?
Well, thanks to my family and my decision to go to rehab and to the Buddhism that I've been practicing now for 40 years. At the time, it was 20-some-odd years that I've been practicing Buddhism, but that really, really kind of helps solidify my resolve. And, I mean, that's really what it took for me to overcome that demon in my life.
Well, speaking of Buddhism, I wonder, I'm going to make a connection. Tell me if I'm right or wrong. You've always been fascinated by improvisation and music. You've always done it. And I think of improvisation, when it's done well, as this transcendental moment where the brain and the body are working in harmony. Do you see a link there to your Buddhist practice?
Yes. Because really, music is about life. Music isn't about music. And so if I just buried my head in music books and constantly just kept in earbuds listening to music, that can only help me go so far. But because Buddhism really helps to clarify your life, clarify your perception of yourself and your relationship with the world around you and the people around you, helps to develop the priceless jewel that is your life. And those aspects of life that you cannot buy, which are compassion, wisdom, courage, integrity, respect for others, those kinds of things. I mean, that's when Buddhism really comes into play. And so that affects the whole of your life, and consequently, it has affected the way I even look at music. I look at music now, I think about things like purpose. Mm-hmm. I never used to think that way before. But, I mean, it's a much larger vision that I have now than I did before I began practicing Buddhism.
Right. Music has the potential to be self-absorbed or technical. And you write that Buddhism made you think about others, other people, through your music. How does that show up, though, in what we hear you play?
Because I'm not thinking about just the notes that I'm playing, or I'm not thinking about, oh, what is the bass line that I'm going to start with. I mean, those things are not the uppermost elements in my mind when I'm actually playing music. I'm thinking about connecting with people. I'm thinking about sharing a bit of the clarity that I perceive in life through my practice of Buddhism. I think about the fact that I would like to, from the stage, help to encourage others to feel a sense of the importance of we and not just the importance of me. Of course, the me is important, but it's important as part of the we. Hmm. I mean, those kinds of things really come from my Buddhist practice.
Well, I want to walk through a few moments in your career, and I want to start with your first audition with Miles Davis. Now, you were established. You'd played with some huge names already. You'd been around the scene, but Miles Davis was already a towering legend. What was going through your mind? What was it like when you sat down the first time to play for Miles Davis?
I was scared. I was kind of terrified the first time I played for Miles Davis. Actually, the first time, Donald Byrd, great trumpet player who discovered me and brought me from my hometown, Chicago, to New York, and really nurtured me. He got my first record contract. He's the person that told me to keep my own publishing, and he showed me how to create my own publishing company. He's the one that actually brought me to Miles Davis's house back in the early 60s and to meet Miles. And what happened is, as he suspected, is Miles asked me to play something. And I felt very, very nervous, and so I decided to play a ballad. I didn't want to play anything up-tempo because I thought, no, I'm too nervous to do that. And anyway, what Miles said after I played, maybe it was Dollar by Starlight or something, the My Funny Valentine maybe, he said, wow, nice. He said, nice touch. And I was thrilled that Miles gave me that kind of compliment. I had no idea at that time that maybe a year later that Miles would call me and ask me to be in his band.
You ended up playing on the album Seven Steps to Heaven and then a lot more with Miles. It took a while to understand that you were actually in Miles's band, though, even after playing with him for a while.
Miles never said you were auditioning or what. And I kind of thought that him asking us to come over to his house every day for 3 days was an audition for being in his band. And this is what I had been led to believe. But Miles said, we're going to make a record. So, although he was just specifically talking about making a record, in fact, I was in his band.
One track that moved me very much from the album Sound System, Carabelli, percussion, vocals, but then it's mostly just you and Wayne Shorter making joyous music. Can you talk about playing with someone you know so well, a friend, and sharing that moment with someone?
Oh, Wayne Shorter. Wayne Shorter is like Yoda. Right now, he's 81 years old, and he's at the top of his game. He has expanded into orchestrating symphonic music with his quartet, and it's a whole new direction that you cannot pin a particular genre label on. So he's carving out new territory in music, and I have so much respect and love for him, and I learn from him every day.
Now, another moment that was pivotal for you, it sounds like. You played a concert with the Pointer Sisters. Your band and their band shared the bill. How did the Pointer Sisters change the way you thought about your music?
Well, the Pointer Sisters and me, we had the same manager. And the manager had gotten us a gig at the Troubadour in Los Angeles. And the Pointer Sisters were an opening act to my band. Now, my band was a very far-out, spacey, kind of untethered jazz group. And the Pointer Sisters were highly influenced by music from the sound of the 30s. But they were young and energetic, and they were fun. And they had, you know, the clothing that they wore was part of their show. I mean, they put on roller skates and anyway, what they did was fun for the audience. What we did was heavy for the audience, and the audience loved them. And I learned a lot from them. Instead of being intimidated by their show and their presentation, I started to think, what is it that I can learn from them And how can I translate that into something that can help cut the barriers between this music that I thought was valuable to present to the listeners? What can I do to open up those channels so that people can really hear what it is that we're doing? They were a big influence in me looking at a bigger picture than I had perceived before.
One of the results of that was the album, the Headhunters album, and the song Chameleon. What was it like when you found out how that was selling the first week?
I couldn't even compute that. I couldn't quite fathom what that meant, and because those kinds of sales were never in my radar before. So it took quite some time before I realized what was really happening. But of course, I was extremely pleased that we were getting the reaction that we were getting. Frankly, on stage, we were all having fun.
Hmm.
We were enjoying the music we were playing and enjoying the challenges that we were setting up musically, and it was, in a way, I was just thinking that, in a way, it was like sports, you know, when you're perhaps playing tennis with someone. I mean, you're opponents, but not really. You're having fun challenging each other, and consequently, you're exercising, you're helping your body. And that's a kind of physical growth and mental growth that you're having with that kind of experience. And maybe that's a kind of comparison to my experience with Headhunters and my experience with music in general.
Herbie Hancock, this has been a high point of my year. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Herbie Hancock is a celebrated pianist, keyboardist, composer, and band leader.